You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes.
On today's episode, we are joined by author Viviane Shaw for a discussion of Slipstream. Slipstream is a 1989 science fiction film directed by Steven Lisberger. Civilization has been destroyed by climate change, and a vast wind current, the Slipstream, encircles the post-apocalyptic globe. Bounty hunters Will Tasker and Belitsky catch a man on the run, only to lose him to the small-time arms dealer Matt Owens, who hopes to obtain the reward for the prisoner. Along the way, Matt learns his prisoner is an android who has become a scapegoat for the catastrophic harmonic convergence. Mixing elements of the Western with science fiction, sometimes reminiscent of Hayao Miyazaki's Nausicaa, but also of Mad Max and other post-apocalyptic movies of the 1980s, Slipstream was Mark Hamill's first role after Return of the Jedi.
Viviane Shaw is not actually from anywhere. She writes about monsters, both in and out of classic horror literature, medicine in its many forms, machines, extant and fantastical, disasters and their causes, and perhaps most importantly, found family. She is the author of the Dr. Greta Helsing contemporary fantasy novels, Strange Practice, Dreadful Company, Grave Importance, Bitter Waters, and Strange New World, and the sci-fi horror novella, The Helios Syndrome. She reviews for The Washington Post, and her short sci-fi horror fiction has appeared in Uncanny, Pseudopod, and The Deadlands.
Welcome, Viviane Shaw, to After Images podcast. We're delighted to have you with us today for a discussion of Steven Lisberger's Slipstream.
Delighted to be here.
And as you know, we like to open our conversations with a very simple, or I should say deceptively simple question, which is, why did you suggest Slipstream and what does it mean to you?
It's one of my favorite movies, and it's also one of the strangest movies that I've ever seen. And I just rewatched it in preparation for this conversation, and it has not aged well. But there's a lot of stuff in it that I think deserves to be looked at and unpacked. And there's some wonderful character notes in there that I only realized in the latter day. I've actually used a lot in my own fiction, and in some of my characters that are in my current book series have a lot to do with the characters in Slipstream.
Mm-hmm. When did you see the film for the first time?
I do not know. It must have been in the 90s. I remember my parents got it out of a Blockbuster. Mm-hmm. Back when there was such a thing as Blockbuster Video. And we watched it. My parents would get random movies out of the Blockbuster and we would watch them together. And some of them were terrible. Some of them were fascinating. And I always remembered this one because it has such a strange collection of cameos from really, really significant, serious actors at mm-hmm. the same time as being so incredibly schlocky and like Mad Max knockoff. Mm-hmm. It has Robbie Coltrane in it. It has F. Murray Abraham. It has Ben Kingsley. And it has Bob Peck, who plays one of the main characters and who is actually a Shakespearean actor. Mm-hmm. Although most Americans tend to know him from Jurassic Park. He was Robert Muldoon, the gamekeeper who got the line, "Clever girl." Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's got such a weird collection of amazing actors and not the world's best dialogue. And they're doing their best with it.
Yeah, that's right. But what a lucky find for your parents, because I was reading that in North America, the film didn't even have a cinematic release. It went straight to video. And today, on some of the more general sites like Rotten Tomatoes, they don't even have enough consensus to give it a rating. That's how few people have seen the film. So can you pitch the film to us? What is memorable about the film? What is important about this film? Why should our listeners watch it?
Because it's actually these days, it's slightly more relevant than it was when I was a kid because of climate change. The main premise of the film is that in the future, all of the terrible things that we've been doing to the planet have screwed up the climate so tremendously that we've gone all post-apocalyptic about it. and all of the weather patterns are screwed up completely. And there is a river of wind known as the slipstream, which is right near the surface of the planet, and which now is basically the only weather phenomenon there is. And people can fly in the slipstream, but it's also incredibly powerful and so not under people's control that certain elements of people in the film actually worship it as a sort of god. It's very Mad Max-y, only instead of in post-apocalyptic desert Australia, most of the filming was actually done in two places that are completely disparate, but actually look really good together. One of them is Cappadocia in Turkey, and the other one is Yorkshire in the UK. And because these places are so wildly disparate, but they look like they could be part of the same world, the location work actually really, really works with the premise of the film.
That's such a good point. Those troglodyte houses are so impressive. And then we've got those kind of like sweeping plains in Yorkshire. It's a great combination. It really, I think, to that opening scene, which I think must have been filmed in Yorkshire, that very impressive chase scene along the kind of cliffside and how open that is and how difficult it is in the beginning, I think, to situate the film. Do you remember your earliest response to that film and wondering how to situate yourself as a viewer?
I had absolutely no idea what to expect. All I knew is there was this guy in a three-piece suit running across what looked like either the Yorkshire Dales or Derbyshire. And I'm English, so I recognized that landscape relatively quickly. But here was this person in extremely nice clothing running across this landscape while a very strange-looking plane was chasing him. So immediately my sympathies were with the guy in the suit because, like, you always sympathize with the guy who's running away from the evil plane.
Yeah, the film is interesting because it's atypical, isn't it? I mean, it
Very.
mixes genres in a way that is very specific, that is very idiosyncratic, something that you don't usually see in post-apocalyptic movies. I mean, it does have elements of Mad Max, but the emphasis that is put on the importance of the slipstream makes it very easily recognizable, and the importance of flying that is a recurring motif in the film.
Yes, absolutely. If you can't fly in this world, you're basically stuck wherever you happen to be.
And did the theme of climate resonate with you as a young viewer at the time, or is that something that has become, increasingly important as we enter into this present, well, what we now know is the Anthropocene?
Definitely, it didn't signify to me, as opposed to like, oh, an apocalypse has happened, fine. I don't really need to know what caused it. I just need to know that now we're in the situation where there is this river of wind, and like that's kind of the whole setting is the river of wind. And I say this right now as the wind outside my window is howling. Santa Fe is one of the windiest places I have ever lived, and we're on the third floor. And so every time the breeze picks up, it sounds like a freight train outside my window. So I'm very sensitive these days to climate, especially since my wife has her day job is in climate policy. So I'm very much more aware of it than I was as a little kid. And I appreciate the film, I think, differently now than I did.
And it's interesting that in the 1980s there was a whole series of post-apocalyptic movies. It was a recurring occurrence on the screen, not just Mad Max, but you had hundreds of them, Americans, Australians, Italians. But I don't have the feeling that we have this so much right now, whereas climate change is much more a problem today than it was in the 1980s, isn't it?
I think probably what was behind the post-apocalyptic boom of the 80s in the film world was the fact that the Soviet Union was right there and they had a lot of nukes pointed at the United States and vice versa. So the idea of the world turning into a howling wasteland because of nuclear winter seemed a lot more possible than it currently does. And kids these days, as it were, don't know what it was like to grow up in a world where the big bad was right there and they could shoot us anytime they wanted, and like there would go the world. And there were movies like Threads and Day After Tomorrow, or what was it? not Day After Tomorrow, the American one that was like Threads Light, that actually approached what would happen in a post-nuclear world that was like very on the nose. But I think that's why there were so many, and we pick up the bits after some unimaginable apocalypse has happened, and we try to like figure out what to do with it, which is why the Mad Max trilogy went so hard.
And within this post-apocalyptic landscape, and these questions of climate change, there's also a very interesting discussion of sentience or personhood within this film. And I think that that resonates so strongly with your work as a writer. I love your books, and this question of personhood comes up regularly. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. The nature of what it means to be a person is kind of central to my work. And as a kid, I absolutely loved the idea of AI. Like, I was really into Knight Rider. I loved 2001. I was definitely on HAL 9000's side, and the guy got such a raw deal. But like, I never thought that AI would actually exist in the world, and of course it doesn't. That kind of AI cannot and will not ever exist in the world because it's completely fictional. What we have now is just, it's such a waste of time, resources, money, water, etc., and it's never going to be anything more than a plagiarism engine that wastes like the world's resources. So I'm bitter about that because if I was going to have AI, I wanted it to be interesting AI, like the kind that's explored in Slipstream. The character of Byron as an android, we don't even realize he's an android until like a fairly significant part into the film. And then the rest of it is about him as like, can he have feelings? Can he be a person? What does it mean to be to have dreams? Like, because he actually gets at some point to finally sleep with his eyes closed, which for him is world shattering. And he gets to dream about the sort of promised land for androids at the end of the slipstream. But yeah, for me, finding out what it means to be a person has been central to my books because they're all about monsters. And instead of the monsters being automatically the bad guys, the monsters tend to be much more sympathetic than many of the humans are. So at one point, my main character, Greta, says something along the lines of, "You may not be human, but you're all people, and you all deserve the right to access care without putting yourselves in danger." So that was always a thing that meant a great deal to me, and I fell in love with Byron when I was a kid, and I still have a huge, huge crush on the guy.
And there is something definitely romantic about him. The beginning scene when he's on top of the cliff is a typical romantic image of Byron facing the elements, isn't it? There is
Absolutely.
something
It's
about
very
that
sort of
poet.
Heathcliff.
Yeah.
I love the fact that he uses a line from John Gillespie McGee's poem High Flight, touch reach out my hand and touch the face of God. And that shows up later as Mark Hamill is the villain trying to, at the absolute last minute, get Byron to save his life. And of course, it semi sort of works, but only semi. I love that because that poem is so incredibly eloquent and really, really brief digression. I also love books written by people who've actually experienced things that most of us will never get to experience, such as astronauts. One of my favorite astronaut books is by Michael Collins, who is the command module pilot on Apollo 11, flying around the moon while everybody else went and had fun on the surface of the moon. He was the one doing the waiting for them to come back. And he was an amazing author. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he wrote a couple of books, one of which is called Carrying the Fire. And in Carrying the Fire, he quotes the entire John Gillespie McGee's High Flight poem. And he says at the end of it, like he's describing what it was like to look at the Earth from orbit and how incredibly stunningly gorgeous it was, and how he felt like the most privileged human alive because he got to see that. And so he quotes the entire McGee poem, and then he says, "All that from the cockpit of a Spitfire. What could he have said after one orbit? I cry that he was killed." I mean, how beautiful is that? So that poem means a lot to me, and I think it means a lot across the board. And the fact that they used that line really just makes that entire scene just like sing.
And it's so unexpected, I think, somehow in this film. That's what makes it one of these really interesting gem type discoveries, this relationship between poetry, disaster, what it means to have empathy and to be a person, all of these questions kind of crumpled into one. And I think that role of poetry is so central in the film, even though we make a joke out of it initially, because of course the character played by Bill Pullman doesn't even recognize Byron when it's quoted to him.
Yeah, he has no idea. I think it might be Bill Paxton. I forget the guy's
Bill
name, but he
Paxton,
plays
I'm
the
sorry.
exact same character every single time I see him. I think he was in Titanic as well. He was playing the salvage operator guy. He plays the exact same character every time I see him. The only time I have ever seen that actor do anything slightly different was actually when he was in Apollo 13 and he was playing Fred Hayes. And even so, it was still kind of like this actor doing a version of Fred Hayes. But he's kind of perfect as a foil for Byron because he's just so completely venal and cheerful and down to earth and grubby. And here's Byron, who's so much more sophisticated in every way. And they end up forming this extremely weird, unexpected friendship by the end of it, which I think is actually earned. I don't think the romance between Paxton and the female cop character really works for me. I think it's just sort of shoehorned in at the end, but I do believe the weird friendship between the two main male characters.
But if Paxton always plays the same character, it was interesting to have Mark Hamill play against that, wasn't it?
Yeah, I love that. Apparently, this was right after he got done with the last of the original Star Wars trilogy. And as far as I can remember, the producer of Slipstream actually also was involved in producing the last two Star Wars films of the first trilogy. And so I don't know if they had a conversation that went along the lines of, "Hey, Mark, want to not be a good guy for a second?" And Mark Hamill was like, "Oh yeah, absolutely." You can tell he's having the best time with it, just like chewing that scenery. It's like, yay, I get to not be the good guy for once. I get to like be evil and villainous and have fun and pilot a weird little like strange plane. I looked that plane up. It existed. It was an experimental plane, which I think it was called like an Optica or something like that. It was designed to be a light aircraft that could work instead of a helicopter that was like easier to fly than a helicopter. But I think they made like 22 of them and it never went anywhere.
I was wondering if we could come back to this question of sentience and maybe piggyback onto something that I also find very, very central in your writing, which is the idea of the chosen family. You have obviously marginalized peoples who choose family, come together, form a unit, a supportive unit where solidarity is something very central. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, how much you think the film might have played a role in that, consciously or unconsciously.
It's another important thing in my work because found family to me is personally very important. As I moved to the United States with my parents when I was 7 years old, and the entire rest of my family was back in the UK and still is. And I developed family outside of my blood family because it was just so much easier, especially once the internet came along, to create relationships with people that you never actually encountered in real life, but you knew them on the other side of the computer screen. And these people would nurture you and be supportive and help you explore storytelling and like characters in ways that you wouldn't necessarily be able to have done on your own. And so found family's been a thing that has always been important to me as a person and also to me as an author. I would say most of my favorite pieces of media that involve some kind of group of people coming together from completely disparate backgrounds and forging something that's much bigger than just the sum of the parts out of it. That's always been, to me, narratively interesting. And in Slipstream, you sort of have that in the ruined museum, which is like now an underground bunker type of place where these people are hiding away from the extremely unpleasant outside world, such as it is. And they definitely do not feel like they're, I don't know, coming together to face some greater evil. They're basically coming together to pretend it isn't happening. So when we find people who are part of that weird collection of like refugees who have who want to do something other than just sit there and pretend that the world outside is not post-apocalyptic and evil, there's definite there's conflict within the people inside the museum. Some of them definitely don't want these people to ever get to leave again, lest their secret bunker be discovered and their way of life be destroyed. Some of them want very much to have their little tiny world expanded to learn what's outside and if they could actually have something more interesting than the exact same dinner party night after night after night. But it made some more sense to me that in a situation like that, where all of these people are surviving together in what is effectively a bunker, that you don't really get a found family. You get a sort of like people squished together in a suboptimal environment, and the worst of their personalities sort of comes to the surface because there's nowhere else for it to go.
Yeah, it feels very endogamic, doesn't it? It feels as if they are not willing to get in touch with the wind of change somehow that is happening outside, to go with the flow. And but this notion of the wind, I think, is very interesting and very unique to the world of Sleepstream. I can't think really of any other post-apocalyptic film that lays such an emphasis on the wind, except perhaps with Nausicaä, you know, the film by Hayao Miyazaki. If you've seen this one, but there's also a very strong link with flying and the wind in Nausicaä.
There's a bit of it in whichever one of the Mad Max movies. I think it's Thunderdome, has the guy with the air truck or his autogyro or whatever it is. And I think that there's a really good reason why wind and flying aren't that much of a post-apocalyptic trope that shows up that often. Because ground vehicles are easier to repair and replace bits of. And when an engine blows in a car, you're not immediately going to die. Whereas if an engine blows in a post-apocalyptic held together jerry-rigged plane, that's basically curtains for you and whoever's on that plane with you, which is why I'm surprised that they even managed to do any kind of aviation in the Mad Max world, because it's harder than people think to keep those things flying under the best of conditions. But yeah, flying in the world of Slipstream, I think you can get away with the idea that you could sort of be a glider pilot in that world if you were smart enough about it and you had a very specialized glider plane. Like you could possibly fly without actually having to have an engine. And that would be an interesting thing to explore in a world like that one. It's like, can you exist without actually having to like land and refuel, or can you stay aloft all the time? And actually, the Bill Paxton character's his deal is he wants to retire from being a gunrunner and like set up this little weird world of balloons, which stay up on their own and you don't need engines to work them. So he wants to live in the kind of like floating utopia thing. Which I thought was an interesting character note for him. It gives him more depth than the character would otherwise necessarily earn.
There's something of Laputa in this utopia. I don't know exactly how you're supposed to pronounce it, but this floating island that you find in Gulliver, this utopia. There is an element of a utopia that you find in the film, also with the place where androids go at the end of the world. You have those goals that are there just beyond the reach of the characters.
I like the idea of there being this mystical, like far off promised land for androids. And then the actual storyteller in me says, but how the hell would that work? Like, how would that work? Would they have built their own utopia? And how would that have come to pass? And how long has it even been since the climate apocalypse that gave rise to the situation? Like, these are questions that the film does not answer. And I think that that is a function of the fact that it's not all that well thought out. And a lot of the questions that it raises are not ones that it can answer. But it's the kind of thing that I would like to play with. If I were given the ability to go back and revisit that world, I would address certain aspects of it that I think the film really could have done more with.
So are you thinking about writing Sleepstream 2?
That would be nice. I can't get hold of the intellectual property, but yeah, that's the other thing I've been doing is playing with screenplays. I just did an event yesterday for Strange New World at a local bookstore, and one of the questions that they were asking was about like writing as cinematic versus writing as like purely intellectual or purely literary. And I found that I am definitely cinematic. Like I write down, I see a movie in my head and I write it down pretty much shot for shot. And this is why when I talk about what's happening in my books, I often talk about what's happening on screen as opposed to like on the page, which is the same thing, but it has slightly different valence. And I love the challenge that comes with trying to tell a story that is largely just done via dialogue. And screen directions are there for the director's benefit, but no one ever sees those unless they're just reading screenplays for fun. So it's a challenge trying to write cinematically because you have to figure out how much of that you want to convey through dialogue, how much through description, and stuff like that. But I would love to take that and run with it as a challenge, see if I could do something different with Slipstream.
And where do you think that comes from? Are you a very visual person by nature, or do you think that this builds on maybe a cinephilic kind of culture that you grew up with?
I'm definitely very visual. I was a visual artist long before I actually started writing. I did both of them when I was a tiny child, but I was drawing long before I could read or write. And then, as soon as I could write, I basically started telling stories. And I was writing novels when I was about 11. Well, they were novellas, they were about 20,000 words. But for an 11-year-old, you know, that's not too bad. But yeah, I've always been very, very visual. And I see things and I describe what I see. It's so much easier to do it with words than it is with a pencil, but it is the kind of difficult that I enjoy doing it with a pencil, but it's so much easier doing it with words.
Have you ever considered doing something with comic book, perhaps?
Weirdly enough, I'm actually playing with that right now with an idea that I had a couple of years ago. I don't know how to write comic scripts, so I'm sort of teaching myself by kind of reverse engineering it because I read a lot of comics, like a lot of comics, and I have always really enjoyed graphic novels in general. So the way I'm trying to write this comic script is by looking at the way I want the page to be laid out and then basically describing the putative artist, if anyone ever ends up doing anything with this, put their spin on what I've described. But I'm trying to give them as much direction as possible so that my vision naturally comes sort of through. But this is also why like I tend to want to storyboard scenes when I'm writing an action scene because I need to like block it. I need to know where people are and how they get from here to there. This is also why I'm like the most annoying first reader for people who don't necessarily do that automatically. And I'm like, okay, but how did they get from that end of the corridor to that end of the corridor without passing the guy in the middle with a gun? How did they do that? I'm like, oh, right. So I am that person who asks how the blocking works.
And thinking of your writing, I'm interested to know what kind of influence science fiction had. I know you've written some short stories that might be categorized in the science fiction genre. For me, a lot of your novels, I would classify them as a genre that I absolutely love, which would be cozy gothic. But I think that's a household term that we talk about here because it's something that we love. But I'm just curious how you situate yourself in terms of the genre question and different influences.
I think, and obviously, the genre that somebody is marketed in is not, it's completely fluid. It's up to their agent and their editor and their editor's team as to what they think the best way to situate a certain piece of work would be to get the most reader engagement. So, the Greta Helsing series is, I think, classified most easily as urban fantasy. I've been on a bunch of panels about urban fantasy because people read the thing and they're like, ah, yes, you are a correct person to talk about urban fantasy. Okay, I guess. But I think cozy gothic is definitely like an aspect of this. And I really like the idea of doing cozies in general. And I wish that I was much better at writing mysteries than I am, because I think I would love to do cozy mysteries. I just don't really have a plot to hang a story on, and you kind of need to start there if you're going to do anything mystery-wise. But yeah, I do write what I would consider hard sci-fi. And the thing that I'm semi-working on now is provisionally titled Hard Bargain. And it's definitely hard sci-fi. It's set in space or on space stations. It's partially a medical procedural set on a space station, and it's partially a political thriller. It's becoming more of a political thriller as it slowly evolves. So I'm not sure how much of the medical procedural is going to last, but I do write that. But most of my short fiction I would classify as horror. Different like slices of horror. They're almost all the same story, which I'm surprised no one has actually picked up on yet, but they are the same story. The story is about what if something that you thought was normal and true and standard and ordinary and believable suddenly turned out to not be any of those things, and you have to deal with it. Go. And I learned this because I am a completely inveterate Stephen King fan, and he taught me how to write short fiction. And I didn't realize that I could do this because my whole writing career, I'd never managed to write a short story that made any sense because it's not a form that comes easily to me. And then I had this idea, which became the story, The Utmost Bound, which is in Uncanny Magazine. And it's, I think, either the best or the second best short fiction I've ever done. And it was the first one I ever wrote. And that was a combination of inspiration. And these things sort of like filled up my brain to the point at which it just overflowed into a story. And then I discovered, okay, I can write short fiction. I just have to decide I'm doing that. But it's all horror. I don't think any of my short fiction really could be described as horror-free. All of them are, there's that sensation of suddenly gravity's pulling the wrong direction, or suddenly the floor isn't there under you anymore and you don't know what to do about it and you're flailing. That's the thing that I'm really interested in, that I write about in short fiction.
And does this medical interest come up regularly in everything that you write? And if so, where does this come from, this interest in kind of medical science?
Absolutely. That's across the board. It's been a thing my whole life. I used to want to be a doctor, and I wanted to be a doctor right up until I realized, A, I really can't do math, and B, I really don't like people that much. And also C, in the real world, I would have to deal with insurance companies, and I would really rather stick my foot in a bacon slicer than do that on a daily basis. So instead of going through all of the intensely painful and expensive work that it would take to become a physician, I just read the medical textbooks, which you can get hold of if you worked, as I did at the time, for a university that has a major health sciences library. You can get hold of incredibly expensive textbooks for nothing at all. And I read all the textbooks that I wanted, and then I just started writing characters who happened to be doing the kind of medicine that I wanted to practice, which is effectively general practitioner, like GP stuff from effectively like England in the 40s and 50s. So, not like industrialized medicine, not in a hospital, not hyper specialized, but basically someone who can take care of people and deal with various kinds of health conditions without being fazed by them, who knows what they're doing, who's competent. And just, I like the concept of a person who can face the unexpected with equanimity, and also who can fix people when they go wrong. So the doctor character has been a major standby for me, like throughout. And people ask me, like, where does the character of Greta come from? And largely it's, I needed a foil for the inhuman characters. I needed somebody who works with them, who lives in their world, but who is also a person, just a person. She has no powers. She has no special abilities other than the fact that she is a qualified physician. She can't do anything amazingly outre. She's just a person. And so she was a perfect foil for all of these extraordinary people that she works with. I like the idea of a doctor being somebody who's qualified to deal with the unexpected and at the same time really be down to earth and not extra special in any way.
Also, I think a general practitioner is someone who has a personal relationship with the patient, who gets to know them, who gets to know their personality, which I think is important in the case of monsters, because then it's possible to reveal that they are just not that. I mean, they're not limited to being monsters.
Yeah, exactly. She was somebody who they would open up to and trust, despite the fact that she was, in fact, just a human, because she understood who they were and where they came from, and she respected that, and she respected their particular species, like taboos and requirements and so on. And that was actually fun to play with. Like the in the first book, Strange Practice, we see a lot of the ghoul society, and they are scavengers, but they also eat their own dead. And it was interesting playing with that because she knows that they eat their own dead, and she was very sympathetic to the fact that at one point one of these ghoul tribes had to leave some of their dead behind and they couldn't come back and consume their bodies because they had to escape from a situation. And like that was incredibly traumatic for the ghouls, and Greta got that. That was fun to like come up with that and write that scene.
Like an anthropologist.
I feel like Dr. Helsing would have a lot of fun with the character of Byron, and that she
Oh
would
my
be
God, yes.
fascinated by him.
Weirdly enough, I didn't realize that this was the case for many years, but in point of fact, there's a lot of overlap between Byron and the character Fastatalkalon, who looks very similar, as a matter of fact. I based him in the books, like his physical appearance actually is sort of based off of David Strathairn in the film Good Night and Good Luck. If you want to think what Fastatalkalon looks like, he looks like David Strathairn playing Edward Artmerrow. That's what he looks like. But I would also take Bob Peck playing Byron the Android. It's very similar. It's sort of like thin, long-faced, very sort of bankerly look. And at the same time, really intense and kind of haunted. But there's some stuff about like the way Byron doesn't really recognize that the things he can do are spectacular, like when he fixes the little kid's cataracts, which we don't actually get to know how he does that, which I imagine has to do with like some kind of weird android powers, but right, like he zapped the kid's lenses with his fingertip and suddenly they were no longer cloudy. I don't know. But we see him suturing somebody's wounds with effectively a hair out of his head. It's freaky. It's also fascinating. And he doesn't seem to think of this as in any way special. He's just like, well, it needs to be done. I'm trying to help, so obviously I'm doing this. And that's part of what Fastatalkalon has always done, is it needs to be done, so he's doing it. The completely selfless thing, which I really enjoy. And the character who doesn't really recognize that what they're doing is special, but is doing it anyway. I think I partially learned that from Byron.
And they also have interesting brushes with death, or what we imagine to be death, but then somehow they're always back, aren't they?
Yeah, well, he's indestructible. His clothes are not. He's hell on clothes. So he goes through at least like two separate suits completely like destroyed by the end of the movie. But he looks really good in them before they get destroyed.
There's one element of the film that we haven't discussed yet, and that nonetheless plays an important role, I think. It's the fact that, in my opinion anyway, there's a strong ele element of the Western in the film.
Yes.
I don't know if you can say a little something about that.
I definitely think there is, and that's it goes back to like the post-apocalyptic idea is not that far off from the frontier idea. Is the law and order has broken down, the old order is gone, people are out there doing basically whatever they can get away with, and there is law in the form of Mark Hamill and the lady cop whose name I have completely forgotten. She's basically there to be a foil for Mark Hamill, and she does that. She's fine. She also flies the plane. But yeah, she and Mark Hamill are the law, but we're not even clear on to what extent that law is actually official or if they're basically like vigilantes who are striking out on their own and they have like fake badges to make people do what they say. But the law is what you make it out there when there's nothing but the river of wind, and whoever has the fastest plane and the biggest gun is going to be in charge.
And did you watch other Steven Lisberger films, or is this kind of a one-off for you in terms of what you've seen over the years?
I did not realize until I looked it up fairly recently that yes, I have watched other Lisberger films, like for example, the original Tron, which I love. The characters in the original Tron are delightful because I think it's the first time anyone's actually done that. Anyone's actually like considered what it would be like to be a program inside a computer and like how weirdly futile it is having to kowtow to like the master control program and how like subroutines are individual creatures and they're all like enthralled to a larger program which works under a larger program. And is that was fascinating. It's just a pity that the physical effects were not up to the story back then. But I think it did give rise to Tron Legacy, which was an amazing film and looked as amazing as it should have done. But yeah, I really like what he was doing with that. And I did not realize that he also did Slipstream.
Franck is positively glowing because Tron, the original, was his special film growing up. So that means a lot to him. And when you suggested Slipstream and I noticed the same character, I was, oh, Franck will be really happy.
That's awesome.
It's true that I had never actually taken the time to watch the rest of his filmography, and it was interesting to discover the variety of his work. He hasn't made a lot of movies, I mean, four, I think, all in all. But Tron, I have to disagree with you about Tron, though. I think the special effect of the first one, in my opinion, is superior to the one in the remake because it is so basic in a sense. I really like the very, very basic nature of it that functions, as far as I'm concerned anyway, and perhaps because I saw the film when I was just a kid, but it really functions so well with the story that's being told. But that's a very personal opinion.
No, I definitely agree that it was visually unlike anything else that anyone had ever seen. And I wish like they could go back and rotoscope the bits where the glowing stopped working for a fraction of a second, like when it just like flickers out. It makes it look weirdly like fey or like supernatural as opposed to like purely electronic. And that's why I like the visual effects on the new one, because you didn't have to do any thought as an audience member looking at it, you got exactly what was going on. Whereas with the original Tron, you did have to sort of fill in the gaps where the light flickered off for a second. And it does require you to do more work, but yeah, I think it was groundbreaking at the time.
Oh, he's happy, but he may be a little biased.
That's fine. Everyone has their own personal perfect movie.
Yes. Is there something you wish that we had asked so far about the film Slipstream? Is there something else that you'd like to cover that we haven't discussed so far about what makes the film special?
Basically, I think you've covered all the stuff that I definitely wanted to get out there. The characters being something that meant a lot to me when I was a kid, and that on later viewings are less and less astonishing, possibly because I've seen so many more things and I've told so many more stories than little me when I first saw the movie did. And there's some stuff that really doesn't stand up to what I remember. I want there to be more thought put into that movie than there actually was. I remember it being more sophisticated than it is. And that's entirely a function of the fact that I'm 45 now. And when I first saw it, I was like, what, 10, 11, 12, something like that. So it's been sitting around for a while. But I like the ideas in it. The River of Wind is so incredibly evocative. There's so much metaphor that goes along with wind in. Like throughout human history, just in popular songs, like the wind of change, that kind of thing. It's like wind is like inherently some kind of metaphor, and they did a lot with that. I think they could have done more with it. And the characterization of Mark Hamill's character as like this, I don't know, I guess like insatiable hunter is sort of what they were going for. You don't really get a clear understanding of why he's doing that, other than that he's doing that. That's just what his character does. And I would like a little bit more. And I would also like to explore a little bit more of Byron, although he is the character who gets the most unpacked. And I think that's important because he is the most interesting character in the entire story. But yeah, the characterization, the setting, and what the setting means, and the nature of what it means to be a person, and of like what happens in a world where everything we knew is no longer the case, the frontier, the cowboy thing. All of those are basically the aspects of the film I find most compelling and that I think people definitely should not miss.
I'm so glad that you've introduced us to this film because it is something that we haven't heard discussed a lot, and we have fan favorites that come back regularly on the podcast, and I'm always delighted when someone suggests the film that we weren't previously familiar with. And I think it's a very hopeful film too, which is interesting for a post-apocalyptic film in the sense that, first of all, the landscape isn't entirely decimated in the sense that there's this beautiful, almost regenerative landscape that we see. And I feel like that really complements the hope that we feel once these people have kind of come together and created a new social group or found a new family. So that's something I was really happy about in the film.
I had the feeling that the wind plays a dual role somehow in the film, that it is an element that drives the characters, but that also drives them. It's a force that can be positive or negative depending on how you function in relationship to it. If you, as I said, if you just go with the flow, it's going to be okay. But if you try to resist it, you could be in big, big trouble. And I thought that was.
Yeah, no, I would agree. The fact that they're using it both as a sort of god that giveth and taketh away. And at one point, they strap Byron to a giant kite and sort of just put him up in the wind and wait for the wind to decide what to do with him. So they don't have to think about whether or not they want to try and like punish this guy for whatever it was they thought he was doing. There's another aspect that sort of goes under the radar of this film, and that's the only reason that people are after Byron in the first place is that he killed a man. And so we think, ah, well, an android has murdered a human, clearly they must be punished, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, rules of robotics. But we realize that in point of fact, he killed his master because his master specifically asked him to do so. So killing his master was his last and like complete act of servitude and love in a way towards the guy he had been created to serve, protect, and entertain, care for, etc., who wanted to not be around anymore. And so Byron was like, okay, I will do the thing that you asked me to do. And knowing that he would be hunted down and punished for it, he did it anyway because that's what he was for. That's a thing that I think I don't really remember understanding much when I was a little kid. And I also think that as a kid, I thought it was less hopeful than it is in the end, because I wanted Byron to live happily ever after with his newfound girl, whatever her name was, Ariel, in the wonders of the buried museum, which actually looked like paradise to me. I would love to live the rest of my life in a museum, just like hanging out with the artifacts. That would be great. And like drinking champagne and having fun and enjoying myself and like talking to F. Murray Abraham. And I mean, that sounds great, right? So I wanted to do that and I wanted him to live happily ever after. And of course, he didn't get to because along come the cops and shoot her and attacked him. And he has to leave behind this sudden place that he has found that he actually feels like he fits in, that he's useful, that he's like good at things and they need him and they want him. And suddenly he doesn't get to have that. And as little me, definitely sort of stuck on that, as opposed to the bit where at the end he's off to find his happy ever after at the end of the slipstream, the end of the rainbow, the end of the story. And I like that it actually is that hopeful at the end. And I didn't really like that didn't stick with me much as a kid, but as an adult, it really does. And I'm glad that I saw it again as an adult so that I could get that out of it, which I had missed before.
Yes, it's interesting that his murder was actually an act of mercy killing, that's totally forgotten by the forces that are tracking him. What you just said concerning the museum and his relationship, the fact that he fits in, is interesting because he does fit in, but at the same time, he becomes again the slave that he used to be. That reminds me that 2 weeks ago we had an episode with Aaron Ehaz, who created the show Avatar, and we discussed Battlestar Galactica, and I think there's a lot there in common with Slipstream, with especially because in Slipstream at one point they call him a toaster, just like they call the Silence toasters in Galactica. The idea that there's a revenge of the enslaved artificial intelligence against the human masters resonates well, I think, with the film, doesn't it?
Yeah, I do. I think that Byron, in the universe of the film, I think he does not in any way resent having been what he was to and for his master. I think he probably does not have it in him to resent. But I think that having now undergone this experience where he gets to be treated as a person, despite the fact that people know what he is, they still treat him like a person. I think that would be the point at which he might develop the ability to resent, because he's developed the ability to want to die. Now he has, I think his horizons have been broadened. But yeah, I think he absolutely would not have. I think he was running away because he didn't want to die necessarily. But I don't think he thought it was unjust that he was being pursued for having done this thing, despite the fact that it was a justified thing for him to have done for and to his master. I think he knew when he did it that he would be hunted down. But I think he sort of acknowledged that that was going to happen and did it anyway, and then went off on this, like, I don't know if he thought he was going to get away or what he expected to happen, but he just sort of went.
There's a feeling of the Frankenstein monster being hunted in the beginning, and once again with this relationship to the elements. I also thought about The Prisoner too, the TV series is escaping from the village.
Interestingly, I think that the comparison between Byron and the Frankenstein's monster is really apposite, because they're both the most sophisticated, emotionally intelligent, like thoughtful, interesting characters in the entire story. Victor Frankenstein is a complete dick. Like, Vic Frankenstein is entirely about Victor Frankenstein going, me, 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 me. It's all about me. And the monster going, oh Christ, okay. Fine. I was made by a dipshit. Let me try and make the best of this because I was made by a dipshit. But I think Byron also fits into that. I am much better than my creator made me. And I am a much better than my creator, and I have to do what they say, despite the fact that I am much more intellectual and morally superior to my creator, but they're in charge, so it goes. I always felt sorry for the monster because he was so much more interesting than Victor.
Absolutely. Well, before we conclude today, may we ask you what's next? What have you got going on right now, and what can we look forward to reading soon from you?
Well, the last book in the Greta Helsing series, Strange New World, just came out this week, and that is the end of the series as far as I am concerned. I am not like slamming the door on that permanently. It's possible that down the road, if I get like a sudden idea in that universe, I might revisit it. But for now, Greta has jumped off Reichenbach Falls, and I'm good with the way the story has concluded. I think it is an earned conclusion to a story that I began telling when I was about 24 years old. And the next long form thing that I'm working on is this story, Hard Bargain. And I don't know when that's going to see the light of day. But there's a couple of short fiction pieces. And other than that, I'm kind of like just sort of sitting there taking a breather because it's been pretty intense the past like several years in a row. So I'm taking a little bit of time for myself to just figure out what I want to do next now that I'm finally done with this particular universe. But the other thing that I want to do that like career-wise is when we do end up moving back to New York City, which is probably going to be within the next 5 years-ish, I want to do the thing I've always wanted to do, which is get professionally into editing. I've been a freelance editor and proofreader for many, many years. And when I worked for the University of Maryland, that's what I did for them. I love it. It gives me life. Getting to sit down with somebody and figure out what they want their work to be doing and where it's working and where it isn't and why and what can be done to push it in a different direction. That is the thing that I love more than anything else. So I'm looking forward to moving into that era of my career in the near future. But there will be more books because there will always be more books and more jewelry. I do jewelry too.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations on Strange New World. We're really looking forward to getting that in our household.
I hope you enjoy it.
Oh, I'm sure we will. I must confess that I've only read Strange Practice and I'm ready to move on to the second one. And I'm told by Franck that this takes place in Palais Garnier, which is where I often work. So I'm very excited.
Oh my God, you do? I love that place. I have now been to Paris exactly twice. I went when I was 18 for a student exchange, and I had taken 8 years of French classes at that point, and I was still not very good at it, but by the time we left France, I was dreaming in French, which was very, very trippy. But I fell desperately in love with it, like I knew I would. And then a couple years ago, my wife and I went back and spent a week in Paris after we were, she was invited to Luxembourg for a convention there, and we tacked on a Paris visit at the end of that. And I had written book two by then. It had, in fact, come out, I believe, by then. And it was so wonderful to be able to go to the various places that are in that book, like Saint-Germain-des-Prés, Les Innocents, and the Palais Garnier, which is amazing. And just be like, oh yeah, I wrote this and I didn't get it too terribly wrong either. It's the most beautiful city and I want to go back, even though I am so bad at French.
Oh.
So the next time you come, you can count on Marissa to be your guide for Palais Garnier and other nice places.
I would love that. I would love
I
that.
love showing people all the secret nooks and crannies of the building. It is a special place.
I was so amazed that the Google Street View has actually expanded to let you see into the cellars and into the fly loft.
Well, I didn't
Yet
realize
you can
that.
actually see the lake in
Oh,
the basement
okay.
where they go diving to like train the divers for the firefighting team. I forget exactly what it is, but it's hooked up with Google Street View. And if you go into like the Palais Garnier on Street View, you'll then see that you can go up or down all of the layers. So if you go down far enough, you can actually see the lake. And if you go up far enough, you can see the dance studio that's in the dome. It was magic. I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. Thank you.
But can you see the phantom?
Yes, but he's very good at hiding in plain sight. You can see the first gear box five, but he's. It was so cool getting to go back there after I had written about it.
Oh,
It was
fantastic.
magic.
So did you use entirely Google and online resources to feed like all of the background that you needed just in terms of navigating the building or?
Largely, yes. Largely, it was that, plus it was blueprints and my own memories, and also blogs written by other people who were exploring. Like a lot of Phantom fans, who go there will actually sort of post like a blog with their various pictures of like, this is first tier box five, this is the loggia, this is the... So I got to use other people's research in that, but largely I did rely enormously on Google Street View and Google Interior View. And it has saved me throughout the entire series from making enormously hilarious factual errors, which I am grateful for. When I first read Strange Practice, what would become Strange Practice after 10 years of having it sit in a drawer, when I originally wrote it in 2004, there was no such thing as Google Street View. So I had to basically go by what I remembered of London, which is extremely inaccurate at the time, and regular maps. And I didn't know, like, I just sort of wrote down stuff and then thought I'll fix it in post. And then I never did. And then when I came back to rewrite it again to actually try and get it published, I was able to look up exactly how a character would get from here to there, what they would see while they were walking along the street. And that was so helpful. It's a thing I recommend to everyone who's writing today is if you're writing about a place that has such a thing as Street View, oh my God, use it because you'll need it and it will help you get the visuals right.
That's so brilliant, but it definitely resonates with what you said earlier about this attention to movement detail that you have just in terms of blocking and how one gets about, one navigates, and that's perfect.
I also am that person who will sort of go, actually, I don't ever want anyone to do actually to me. So I do way more research than I strictly need to so that I can hopefully avoid that.
And in Paris, have you been to the catacombs when you no,
No,
you haven't?
that is the thing that we did not have time to do, and that is definitely on my list.
Well, Marissa can be a good guide once a
It's volunteering me, but it would be a pleasure if ever you're here and you'd like to visit Palais Garnier again, right?
Oh my God, we are so going to take you up on that.
It would be a pleasure. So thank you
you
so
so
much for
much
your
for
time
the
today.
time you've
Of
given
course,
us.
thank you guys very much.
And please also thank again Arkady for the
Putting this in touch
opportunity.
with
Yes.
you. I will.
And
But she sends her best wishes. Thank you.
okay,
And
wonderful. We
ours too.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images podcast on social media.
After Images.